Let me hear your confession, my son.
Well, now, I'm back on the booze.
Ah.
I've got the wife's sister pregnant again.
Right.
And I've just gambled my poor mother's life savings away on a horse.
I see. Well, just say a few Hail Marys and we'll call it quits.
Oh, great. Right, I'm off now. Dave Allen's on in a bit.
What? Dave Allen? Are there no depths to which you won't sink? I don't believe it. Curse of the god! Are you blood?
They all stand around the wig table looking at you with a glass in their hands and they say, here's to your health. I was just going to say, what are you doing with the bishop's shoes on?
I'm Ed Byrne, and this is Dave Allen. Good night, and may your God go with you on BBC Radio 2.
You get a little fella at a party, a cocktail party, goes up to the hostess and says, excuse me, madam, but do lemons have feathers? I beg your pardon. Do lemons have feathers? She said, I don't think so. Why? She said, well, in that case, I've just squeezed your canary into my drink.
Dave Allen was every bit a part of the golden age of TV comedy as the Two Ronnies or Morecambe and Wise. He drew audiences in with his genuine charm, easy wit and distinctive style. He was a poet, a philosopher, a satirist and your favourite uncle all rolled into one.
I think he was one of the greatest comics we've had.
Divilment. It's a good Irish expression, Ed. And he had that.
Warm, friendly, the nearest I've had to a brother.
You just sit there and go, this man is brilliant.
He didn't have to try to be different to all the other comedians, he just was. He was Dave Allen and he was quite unique, really.
Over the next hour, we're going to examine his life and career and discover just why, in many ways, he was Britain's first alternative comedian. He sat down when others stood up, he told engaging stories when others told corny gags, and his comedy ventured into areas that others wouldn't dare approach.
You get a priest and a nun, and the nun turns to the priest and she says, do you ever think that the Holy Father will allow us, members of the clergy, to marry? And he says, I don't think so, Mother Superior. Not in our lifetime, or our children's, but perhaps in our children's children.
So find yourself a comfy chair, or a stool if you've got one, and pour yourself a glass of the good stuff as we pay tribute to a master craftsman of comedy.
You get a nun, gets up in the morning, and leaves and walks down the corridor. And another nun looks at her and says, it's a difficult thing to say, another nun. And says, you got out of the wrong side of the bed this morning. And she goes on down, and another nun says, you got out of the wrong side of the bed this morning. And this happens 15 times, and by then she's livid. And she meets the Mother Superior. And the Mother Superior is just about to open her mouth, and the sister says, don't tell me that I got out of the wrong side of the bed this morning! And the Mother Superior said, I wasn't going to say that. I was just going to say, what are you doing with the bishop's shoes on?
He's the benchmark. Dave Allen is, without doubt, one of the greatest comics of his generation, and he spanned across generations. He managed to influence so many people. I think it's an absolute testimony to his ability as a performer. Not just who he was as a human being, but his ability as a performer of how many people he inspired, and also inspired an incredible sense of love and admiration.
Comedian Mark Thomas talking about the lasting impact of Dave Allen's work. Dave Allen always stood out from the comedic crowd. He was an insightful and perceptive storyteller at a time when mother-in-law jokes and casual racism were still very much the norm. Comedy historian and editor of the Essential Dave Allen anthology, Graham McCann.
I think the most important word in his vocabulary was why, and it really made it the grist for his comedy mill, whatever he thought about. He just questioned things, whether it was sex or religion or politics or authority or any kind of ideology. He always said why, and that really gave him a constant well of comedy that he could just keep coming up with insights because he never just accepted anything.
Dave Allen was a keen observer of the human condition, and in his open, relaxed company, anything and everything was up for discussion. Dave's son, Ed Allen.
For him, I think life is just, he was like foraging for material, you know. That's what he loved, and he'd just walk down the street and something would happen and he'd use it in his act. And we'd pick up a paper and he'd read something very funny or see something on television. He would gather his material as such. Even when he wasn't working, he'd be, you know, gathering.
Here was a unique individual, in more ways than one, comedian Joe Caulfield.
We were living in London, my mum and dad are from Ireland, so I think it was a huge relief to them to see an Irishman on television that wasn't an idiot. and we always watched him absolutely religiously.
Watching Dave Allen religiously? I think he would have appreciated that one. Dave Allen was born David Tynan O'Mahony in Templeogue, County Dublin, on the 6th of July, 1936. His father was Gerard John Cullen, general manager of the Irish Times, known to his friends as Cully, and described as the clown prince of Irish journalism. Cully was famous not only for his wit and larger-than-life persona, but also for being the first baby to be born in Ireland in the 20th century, an honour that saw friends and family gathering around him each year to celebrate. Graham McCann.
Dave Allen was born into a very literate, worldly Dublin culture. His mother was an English Protestant and his father was an Irish Catholic. And so, quite naturally, religion was always there, as it was for anyone in Ireland anyway. But also, they were very cultured people. His father was a great journalist and worked with the Irish Times and was a great friend of Flann O'Brien, for example. And on his birthday every year, you would get really all the great and good of Dublin's literary culture coming to toast his health. And so Dave Allen and his brothers grew up really literally at the knee of these great storytellers, writers, poets, dramatists and so on. And so it was really something in his blood and something that was cultivated throughout his early life, just hearing great storytellers.
Dave and his two older brothers, Peter and John, shared a warm, happy home with their mother, Jean, and a father who had a natural flair for tall tales and spooky stories, as Dave himself remembered.
He had the ability to join with you as a child. I don't say he would become a child, but you wouldn't be sitting there thinking this is an adult being silly. And he did tell stories. One of our great joys, because we lived outside Dublin on the base of the Dublin Mountains, and on a cold night or a wet night or a windy night, was to have a big fire lit and to pull all the chairs up in front of the fire, not sit on the chairs, but sit down on the floor, on the cushions, and for him to tell stories.
Sadly, Cully died in 1948, when Dave was just 12. Losing his father at such an early age was a devastating blow, and without a wage coming in, times were soon hard for the family. Eventually, Dave's older brothers left school to follow their late father into journalism, and he joined them at the age of 16. Dave's career as a junior reporter was short-lived, and he left Ireland and travelled to London in an unsuccessful search for a job in Fleet Street. In the summer of 1955, Dave finally abandoned his fledgling career in print for good and decided on something completely different. You got the blue, I got some new. Going in the fall in your blue sweats. You do the holiday rock. I'll do the holiday rock. Holiday, holiday, holiday. Holiday, holiday, holiday. Go, 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 do the holiday rock. Yes, campers, Dave joined his brother John at Butland's holiday camp in Skegness, becoming one of the famed Redcoats. Not bad for someone whose only previous experience of performing to an audience was as a frog in a school play. As a Redcoat, Dave was expected to work 6 days a week, earning less than £10, but it was invaluable experience. Whatever he was asked to do to entertain the guests, even trying his hand at boxing, Dave's natural sense of playfulness and humour shone through. Here's fellow Skegness Redcoat, Andy King.
The referee, he'd say, right, we're going to get Andy and Dave to give you a little exhibition. Well, we started sparring up to each other And do you know, it was a natural. It was so funny. The things he did while we was boxing, they were laughing. The campers were laughing the socks off. I was there to chase him, to get hold of him, to punch him. And he was turning round, he'd climbing under the referee's legs. And the things he did was, it was a natural. It was very, very funny. Go, 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 do the holiday rock,
This gift for comedy soon earned Dave a place in the Redcoats Review Show, a mix of traditional songs and sketches, and although reluctant at first, it soon became a showcase for his talents. Here's Dave himself talking about it in 2000.
There was a couple of sketches, and I played in the sketches, and a piece of scenery broke sometime, and I had to go out front. And while I was standing out there, I thought, well, I might as well just cut a couple of gags that I knew. So I did, and got a giggle, and then somebody said, you should extend that a little bit more, and then they gave me a kind of 5 or 6 minute spot on the Redcoat Show.
Dave's routines at this stage were a million miles away from the ones that would make him famous. Butlins had strict rules about the type of material its Redcoats could perform, and jokes about sex, politics and religion were definitely off limits. But Dave's act was popular, and he soon teamed up with another camp host, Al Page, to form a double act during a second Butland season in Filey, Yorkshire. After 3 years, they hung up their red coats and began touring their act around small clubs, which wasn't easy. Here's comedian and former red coat, Jimmy Tarbuck.
Well, you were a star, a weekly star with the campers. You had the red coat and that was the passport. You could do whatever you want. Jump in a swimming pool, dance with the old ladies, call the bingo. You were Jimmy the Red Coat or Dave the Red Coat. The highlight of the week for the performers was the Red Coat show and learning a bit about comedy. But what happened while you were a hero for 18 weeks of the year with the campers? You came home and went back on the clubs with hello, with the same corny gags, and they all went, "Aye, right, we've paid our dough, now be funny." And that was a shock, but it was great grounding.
After a few months together, Dave decided to go it alone. He worked hard on his solo act and secured a spot on the BBC talent show New Faces in 1959, which he later described as the longest, most terrifying experience of his life. Dave was soon signed by noted theatrical agent Richard Stone, who immediately suggested he change his name to something, well, a bit snappier. Here's Dave again from 2000.
My surname is Tynan O'Malley, and I tried Dave O'Malley, and I'd arrive at places, and I would be Dave O'Malley, or Maloney, or O'Maloney, or so I thought, well, Tynan is simple enough, so I tried Tynan. So Tynan, for whatever reason, became Tyrone, and Tannen, and Tinnan, so I never knew who the bloody hell I was, and who was on the bill.
Eventually, Dave chose Alan, simply because he'd be top of his agent's client list. Smart thinking. So Dave Allen had arrived, and his workload increased, playing to families at seaside resorts, as well as working the nightclub scene. By the early 60s, Dave was also serving as MC and resident comic for popular music acts of the day, including a performer who was a teenage sensation long before Charlotte Church downed her first alcopop.
I have loved you more each day, walking back to happiness, whoop-a, oh yeah, yeah, said goodbye to loneliness, whoop-a, oh yeah.
60s singing legend Helen Shapiro.
Dave was compere on all of my early tours, right the way through 62 and into 63, and we met just working together. They were what we used to call pop package tours, when a whole bunch of different pop acts would be chucked onto a bus and we'd travel all over the country, play cinemas, city halls, town halls, and they were great. I mean, there'd always be a compere. I mean, even the top of the bill, you know, you'd only do like 25 minutes or something. But you did two shows a night. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, jam sessions on the coach, a lot of singing and stuff going on. It was great.
In 1963, Helen toured the variety theatres and cinemas of the UK again, with Dave as MC. Only this time, she was supported by a group who were poised on the edge of superstardom. You've probably heard of them.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something.
Yes, Dave was once the warm-up man for the Beatles. No pressure there, then.
The beginning of 1963, that was their first ever kind of major UK tour. And that was great, and we would be on the coach, lots of singing, the Beatles and everybody would be singing like very early Tamla Motown stuff. And again, Dave would be joining in with all of that. We just tattle off.
He liked the Beatles. He loved John Lennon because they had the same kind of sardonic wit and Liverpudlian and Irish humour is naturally entwined anyway. And so he got on very well with them like that. And I think he was someone who was also just fascinated with any kind of phenomenon like that, whether it was screaming fans or pop music or the whole music industry. And it made him, again, ideally placed really to observe that, both the admirable aspects and the absurd ones as well.
Helen Shapiro and Graham McCann. It was during this time that two very different women were to play key roles in Dave's career. The first was legendary jazz singer Sophie Tucker, the famed last of the Red Hot Mamas.
I feel so lonely for you only.
He toured with Sophie Tucker and he liked Sophie Tucker and she really saw him as a kind of star in the making and really began to pull strings on his behalf and got him jobs and eventually, I think, was in part instrumental in getting him exposure in Australia.
She'd done a tour in Australia and she wrote to the agent in Australia and said, "I've seen a young comic and I think he's quite good and if you ever have a chance to offer some work, give him a chance. I think he's worth it."
That chance did come along with the offer of an 8-week tour, and Dave gladly seized it. Although stepping onto Australian soil for the first time was something of a culture shock, as Dave himself explains.
I arrived on Easter Sunday, and I thought, where have I arrived? Because I've arrived in Sydney, And there are people playing pitch and toss all over the place. I mean, the whole city is just gambling. At the airport, driving in, they're all throwing money up in there. There's great groups of people throwing money down. And I said, what sort of place is this? I didn't know that there was just a one day that it was legalized. And that night, I worked this returned servicemen's club. And the place just went dark. And a man with a bugle played the last post. And everybody said the Lord's Prayer. And I mean, I thought, what am I doing? What? Here they're all praying. And then the next thing is a girl runs on and the lights go up and she starts to take her clothes off.
Dave quickly adjusted to his new surroundings, but at this stage, he had yet to develop his distinctive comic style. His early act was more of a succession of slick one-liners, delivered in the style of the American acts of the day, although it was to be another American performer, the second of the influential women in Dave's life, who would suggest a different approach. Helen Trouble was a widely respected operatic star who Dave found himself working with in Australia. It was she who encouraged him to include the tales he told offstage about his life in Ireland into his act, to slow down his performance and showcase his natural storytelling abilities. It was a style that defined his comedy from then on.
Duck shooting. In the hide. Very early in the morning. No sign of the duck. I'll have a little drop of rum to keep warm. And still no sign of the duck. And I'll have another little drop. And still no sign of the duck. And to the duck. One big, fat, lonely, dirty duck goes across the sky all by himself. Flap. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And the drunk picks up his shotgun and goes, ba-doom, ba-doom, and out goes into the lake. And his friend's there and he said, That is what I call great shooting. He said, well, you're bound to hit one out of a whole flock.
Much like myself, to promote the Australian tour, Dave appeared on Channel 9's In Melbourne Tonight. However, very unlike me, the next day, sackfuls of fan mail began arriving at the TV station demanding to see more of this new star. Despite the fact he'd only been in the country for a matter of weeks, Dave Allen was now being offered his own TV show. Graham McCann.
I think it was one of those cases when he was in the right place at the right time, that he was in Australia where they were looking for particular kind of types. They wanted someone who could appeal to a mainstream audience and not frighten anyone, but at the same time be bright and witty and inventive and mimic, really, the kind of sophisticated chat show hosts who were becoming the fashion in America, people like Jack Paar. So that was the kind of template they were using.
Tonight with Dave Allen went on to be an incredible success, mixing music, comedy and chat in a way that was ahead of its time.
Because it was live TV as well, it was absolutely ideal for Dave to develop as a comedian because he had an open-ended show. It wasn't just live. There was no definite end point. And so if he wanted to wing something and really go with it, he could.
In 1964, Dave was introduced to a young English actress at a party, Judith Stott. Within a few short weeks, they were married, and they later had two children together, Jane and Ed. His new wife wanted to return to Britain, and so Dave agreed to leave Australia, although not permanently. He would return many times over the next few years to the country that had come to view him as a favourite son. Australia guaranteed him the opportunities to try new things. He appeared in a comic film, Squeeze a Flower, and even released two spoken word singles, another way of expressing the poetic and lyrical side of his nature. Here's Dave performing The Good Earth from 1969.
When I was a child and the road was dark and the way was long and alone, my heart would lift as I turned the bend to see the lights of home. Now high above, in a silent sky, in a still and starry space, man looks down on the earth below, and that blue and green and shining glow to him is the lights of home. It's a good earth, yes, a good earth, a land of sun and rain and snow, of mulberry trees and mistletoe, of burning plains and raging seas, of Sunday morning taking your ease, watching the children grow. It's a good earth. Yes, a good earth.
It's not quite clear why he did them. I think it was in Australia, and there was a widespread fascination for just about anything that he would do at that time. He was much loved and very popular. They're very unconventional Dave Allen records. I think fans of his TV shows who've never heard them would be in for a bit of a shock.
On a return visit in 1971, Dave hosted a special TV show with guests Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Finding their conversations constantly interrupted by an overzealous producer, Dave politely told him to go behind a curtain and masturbate. Never heard it put quite like that before. Dave picks up the story.
The place exploded. I mean, the audience laughed. But from the phone calls, I mean, there were old ladies fainting in Melbourne and throwing themselves off the bridge. And I left the next morning and flew back to London and found out I was banned for live television in Australia.
The ban wasn't permanent, and Dave's popularity ensured he was soon welcomed back. Ed Allen.
Wherever he went over there, everyone loved him. I mean, they loved him more over there than they did here, I think. He loved the country and he loved the people. But, I mean, being 12,000 miles away from your children is kind of hard. But he knew, you know, that's what he did.
By the end of 1964, Dave Allen was back in the UK playing cabaret gigs and somewhat unsure of his next career move. Getting regular TV exposure in the UK wouldn't be as easy as it had been in Australia. It took a fellow Irishman to give him a helping hand.
Now Patrick McGinty, an Irishman of note, fell in for a fortune and he bought himself a goat. Says he, sure of goat's milk, I'm going to have me fill. But when he brought the nanny home, he found it was a bill.
Val Dunican helped him immensely when Val's show was the number one show on the telly. And once again, same type of thing, a very easy performer to watch Dunican. And then he'd bring him on. And it got a very popular spot with the show and enhanced Dave. And of course, even when he had his own show and was huge, he'd still pop on to Val's, you know, and it was a lovely combination.
Val Dunican was due to host a Saturday night primetime entertainment show on BBC One, and the idea of having a stand-up comedy slot to break up the songs had been suggested. The show would soon bring them together, but it wasn't the first time they'd met, as Val explains.
I appeared in a club up in Newcastle, and I met this guy walking along. And he said, oh, how are you? He said, hello, my name's Dave. He said, and I'm your support act tonight. That evening, I stood at the back. And I thought he was great. I went off then. Now, I've been asked to do a little summer season. Bill Cotton rang me one evening at my hotel. Now, he said, how would you feel about, instead of having a different comedian every week, he said, how would you feel about having a resident comedian? Because he said, I was at a function a couple of nights ago and I saw a comedian on there and I thought, God, he'd be great with Val. He'd be just perfect little interlude in the middle of the show. And he said his name was Dave Allen. And I said, I don't believe it. I worked with him a few months ago and I'd never heard of him. He'd just come over from Australia. And so that was planned then, that Dave was to be a resident part of the show. And he did, in fact, do 2 years. And he was great.
The series was a massive success, pulling in huge audiences. And it allowed Dave to further develop his storytelling style.
The second year that he was with us, he had really perfected fitting into the show. And he would tell just a couple of stories, and he used to bring the house down, really. And this went on, and you could see at that stage that Dave was going to be a great big star, really.
Dave's popularity soon brought him to the attention of the commercial networks. In the summer of 1966, he stood in as a late replacement for Tony Hancock, hosting a variety special called The Blackpool Show for ABC. An impressed Lou Grade offered him the resident compere's job on Sunday night at the London Palladium. Dave turned him down, but he eventually did get his man, signing him to star in Tonight with Dave Allen. The show won Dave a Variety Club Award for ITV Personality of the Year and marked a period where he flitted between the Beeb and ITV like some sort of comedy butterfly. One such show was a special for Thames Television called Inside the Mind of Dave Allen. This was the first to feature his trademark mixture of storytelling stand-up and recorded sketches. Someone obviously didn't spot the potential.
I went to Thames and they didn't pick it up. But Bill Cotton, who was head of light entertainment with the BBC at the time, picked it up. He said, I like the idea, and would you, you know, put it together and work on it and let me have another thought?
He did. Bill Cotton liked it, and so the BBC signed Dave to make what would prove to be his most iconic TV series.
Italian. His wife died. And all the way out to the graveyard, he's gone, ah! I don't know, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? All the way back in the garden, goes, I don't know what I'm gonna do. And his friend says, Mario, you must pull yourself together. I know you loved her, but she is the dead. You must live your life. In 6 months' time, you will meet another beautiful girl. And you will fall in love. And you will marry her. He said, 6 months? What am I going to do tonight?
Here, viewers first saw Dave perched on his famous stool, cigarette in one hand, glass of whiskey in the other. Although, under the hot studio lights, he often substituted it for champagne. Dave Allen had now perfected the style that would endear him to millions and mark him out from all his contemporaries. Show writer Peter Vincent.
Dave always worked with cue cards, very large cards on which about six words would be written. And they were nearly always rather rude words. It was... It was an extraordinary thing. And I used to hold these cards, and Dave just... You wouldn't actually see him looking at the cards. He's very skilled. And so it seemed to be that he's absolutely word perfect. But of course, he was doing something that not a great many television performers have done. He was actually recreating it as he did it. He didn't have a written down script. He just had these cards, just single words. It always looked very good like that, I think. It looked like this man was just remembering something funny and talking about it.
The stand-up seemed to dovetail perfectly with the recorded sketches, which also had Dave's imprint. Graham McCann.
For stand-up comedians who did TV shows, typically most of them just turned up and concentrated on their material. And if they had to do sketches, the likes of Tommy Cooper or Frankie Howard would just really sleepwalk through those and not put much effort into them at all. Whereas Dave Allen was very hands-on, and he would collaborate with his writers right from start to finish.
Oh! Oh!
My God! It's a dart!
Oh, no!
Oh, this is a dart. Used by the Igano Indians. Dipped into poison made from the red lime tree.
Oh, and usually used by...
One man, and one man only. My deadly enemy, Mariatti.
Oh, God, Holmes!
Watson?
Yes?
If the poison from this dart is not sucked from your posterior, within the next 15 seconds, you shall die.
So what's going to happen?
You're going to die.
Key to the success of these sketches were the regular troupe of actors who helped Dave perform them. Among them, Ronnie Brodie, Jackie Clark and Michael Charvel-Martin, who worked with him previously on Inside the Mind of Dave Allen.
It's like having a big dressing-up box called the BBC. And also someone gave you money at the end of it as well. I mean, wonderful. You put on a German helmet and do a silly sketch and then become a Viking, then become someone else. You know, I mean, wonderful. Great, great time. And a great laugh.
Hey, boy! I want to talk to you. Stranger in this town, we shoot first and ask questions afterwards. Could you tell me where the railway station is?
For Dave's son Ed, the sketches hold fond memories.
What I loved about them universally was the way that they were brilliantly done. And you don't see those kind of production values anymore. And I think he just loved doing them as well. He always had a great time doing them. I remember going to the BBC once, and it was when he did the one with the confessional boxes as Dodgems. And I just thought, God, this looks like such fun. I thought, what a laugh.
Although more famous as a stand-up, Dave Allen seemed particularly at home in the sketch format, playing a wide variety of historical, legendary and religious characters.
The reading today is from the New English translation of St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Having a lovely time, wish you were here, love, Paul.
And despite being the star, he was a true team player. Michael Charvel-Martin.
You'd be frantically changing for another sketch, and David had some complicated makeup on, and they were saying, come on. And he said, well, let Michael do the sketch, you know. And the bottom line, as he said, is it doesn't matter who gets the laugh in the shows, you know, apart from the fact that it's the Dave Allen show. As long as someone gets the laugh, it doesn't matter who is the star of the sketches.
From clergymen to cowboys, prisoners of war to pirates, Dave played them all, happy to complement the intelligence of his stand-up with somewhat broader humour. Peter Vincent.
He's being condemned to death, and they say, what is your last wish? He whispers to the man, and the man brings a beautiful girl. So Dave Allen and this beautiful girl go into this little hut, and the firing squad, who are waiting to shoot him, sort of wait around for a bit, and then they have a cigarette, and they say, ooh, he's taking a long time. And then they sort of start sitting down, and then they go to sleep. And then the next morning, the door opens, and the girl comes out and says,
you're too late. He's dead.
I'm Ed Byrne, and you're listening to Dave Allen, Good Night, and May Your God Go With You on BBC Radio 2. The first series of Dave Allen at Large pulled in 10 million viewers on BBC Two. So what made his stand-up so popular and so memorable? Graham McCann.
He wasn't like most stand-ups of the time doing gags. but he was really talking about his life. Everything was open for investigation and sharing with the audience so that they could nod in recognition. And I think that made him the most intimate, genuinely charming performer of his time.
The fact that Dave also wrote vast amounts of his own material helped to give him a more recognisable voice, astounding writers like Peter Vincent, who were used to working with more traditional comics.
We had some very, very good ideas, and I suppose 99% of all that was rejected by Dave. And very often, we had a really super script, and then he'd go away and he'd come back the next day with a completely different script, which is the one he wanted to do anyway. And you thought, how the hell can that be funny? And then after the show was recorded and everyone was falling about, you all came into the dressing room, champagne was flowing, terrific. And you think, God knows how that happened. But somewhere along the line, Dave, you know, was a bit of a genius.
If you get a follow, you know how you sit, or people sit in a traffic jam, and they'll read the paper. If you get behind one of those fellows and they're stuck in the paper, they forget the course of time and they're reading away. All you've got to do is blow your horn. They think the traffic's moved on, they'll drive straight in.
Dave Allen's TV success meant he became an even bigger draw as a live act, where he was just as sharp and irreverent. Jimmy Tarbuck.
Well, he did a season in the West End. And he did, yes, he has a gag he did. That was on the front row. He said, "Now tell me, sir, would you like a drink on me?" And the fellow went, looking up at him. "Yes, Dave, is that your wife?" "Well, is it?" "And would your wife like a drink?" "Oh, yes," she said, "I'd love it. A glass of champagne." "Oh, Dave, yes, please. A charrette down the aisle. Will you take these people?" "But yes," and he said, and everyone clapped. "How lovely," he said. "I've been trying to get those miserable bastards off the front row all night. They haven't laughed once." Well, the place just roared. I thought, what a great gag.
Dave's increased confidence as a performer led to him tackling his first straight theatrical role in the Edna O'Brien play A Pagan Place at the Royal Court Theatre in 1972. Reviews were mixed, and although he later played opposite Maggie Smith in a production of Peter Pan, the success of his TV show would limit his opportunities.
Women are very different, actually. For example, you get the two women talking to one another and saying, "I say, isn't that Mr. Carruthers across the road?" "Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Yeah, mm-hmm." She said, "Doesn't he dress nicely?" She said, "Yes, and very quickly, too."
Though his TV series was squarely aimed at adults, many of today's comedy stars were glued to the screen as kids. And, in Dave, they definitely saw an ally. Here's Joe Caulfield.
He was fantastic for children because he made fun of adults. Because everything he did was poking fun at the establishment. So you'd sit there and go, this man is saying that parents don't know what they're talking about. I remember a story he used to tell about his mum saying, "Oh, you know, it was always all day long, when your father gets home, you'll do this. And, oh, your father will put you in the cellar. If you do that, oh, your father will beat you." And then his dad would come home and his dad would open his arms and wait to give Dave Allen a huge hug. And he would run away and hide behind his mum because his mum had painted the dad as a monster. And I thought that was really funny because I thought, oh, you see, parents are idiots. And apparently the adults like it, or maybe they haven't noticed what he's saying.
"What have we got here?"
"Bomb, sir."
"Thank you, Sergeant. Take this down, please."
"Sir."
"The rim screw is connected to the flange bolt."
"Rim screw is connected to the flange bolt."
"The flange bolt's connected to the earth wire."
"Flange bolt's connected to the earth wire."
"The earth wire's connected to the nose cone."
"The earth wire's connected to the nose cone."
"The nose cone's connected to the flip cone."
"The nose cone's connected to the flip cone."
"And hear the word of the Lord."
"Take it away, sir."
"Then bump, then 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 bump."
And he wasn't just entertaining for kids. He was educational too. Mark Thomas.
He plays a white South African preacher. He walks into the church and there's a black guy on his knees. And he says, "What are you doing, boy?" And this black guy looks up and he says, "I'm cleaning the floor." He said, "Ah, thank God for that. For a minute I thought you were praying." And it's a very funny gag. It's a very, very funny gag. And it just cuts to the heart of apartheid. I found out about apartheid by saying to my dad, "What was that about?" I knew it was funny, but what was it about? Dad explained apartheid on the back of a Dave Allen sketch. How much more radical can you get than Dave Allen?
By now, Dave was a superstar in Britain, but he refused to act like one, preferring to blend in with the crowd and continue to observe. Ed Allen again.
He was never into the fame game. He'd do his work and he'd associate with people then, and then he'd come home and be with the family. Fame was never an issue for him. He loved and obviously respected a lot of people he worked with, but he didn't do the whole kind of premiere stuff and being seen out. He kind of kept himself to himself. He loved his work and that was it. And the fame was... He could have done without the fame, to be honest with you, because it was quite difficult.
Clearly, Dave's style of humour struck a chord with British audiences. But are there any other reasons for his popularity here? Well, Mark Thomas has one theory.
Britain likes to be criticised by comics who are sort of outsiders. So you're not actually from here, so you get the permission to look in and look at us. And Britain's very good at that. We don't particularly like it when our own sons and daughters actually do it, but we don't mind it when, you know, Oscar Wilde can do it, and Dave Allen can do it, and Dame Edna Everidge can do it, and Bill Hicks can do it, because they're outsiders, but they're sort of like us, aren't they? And that's a really interesting thing. Dave Allen takes full advantage of it.
The reason we come to your country is because over here, you're a permissive society. In Ireland, we're not. Here, you have sex before marriage. In Ireland, we do not. We come to get our share. The Irish are very good at populating other countries. In more ways than one. So for all you know, you might be laughing at your brother.
Dave Allen continued working on his shows for the BBC, but in 1979, he took time out to star in an Alan Bennett play for LWT called One Fine Day, about a London estate agent going through a midlife crisis. Directing him was a young filmmaker who would go on to make movies such as Dangerous Liaisons and The Queen, Stephen Frears.
It was a rather original idea, and of course, it was comic, so you wanted someone with a sense of humour, and you wanted someone who was thoughtful. You know, where there was more going on inside, behind his eyes, inside his brain. So you're playing somebody who was thinking a lot. Well, Dave, never stop thinking. You know, if you're a stand-up comic, I guess that's what you do.
His performance impressed the cast, crew and director.
He could hold the camera. If you'd start a shot, he could keep it interesting by being interesting himself. And in a way, you know, if that's what movie stars have. You start watching them and then you follow them and there's no need to cut the camera away because they're inherently interesting. And he had that quality. He was an interesting man.
And according to Peter Vincent, these film star looks had at one time also impressed the makers of the most iconic film series of all.
At one point, I think he was under consideration to play James Bond. I don't think it would have worked, but he could have done a sort of James Bond with 9½ fingers. But I think he would have found it so boring that he'd have probably wanted out.
Although Dave never shied away from broaching controversial subjects, he attracted surprisingly few complaints from viewers, except when it came to the one subject particularly close to his heart.
In Ireland, actually, you get what we call the fire and brimstone preachers. And you get the fella in the pulpit, and he's saying, "I will tell you about the great judgment day!" "I will tell you on that day the great book will be opened and all your sins will be on that book." "And the Lord will banish the wicked, and there will be a great weeping and a gnashing of teeth." There's an old woman down the front, she says, "I don't have any teeth." "I said, teeth will be provided."
The critic Jack Waterman once said, "What Lenny Bruce did for sex and the four-letter word, Dave Allen achieved for religion." Before Dave Allen, few comics would dare touch upon religious material, and if they did, it was rarely with his passion and anger. It's a comic lineage that can be now traced to the likes of Father Ted. But why did Dave seem to take so much pleasure in attacking the institutions of the Catholic Church? Graham McCann.
He had a very strict Catholic upbringing, as he called it, God's stormtroopers, and he had all of the slaps and rebukes and threats that were endemic in that kind of culture at that time, and it really instilled in him a tremendous dislike of power and authority generally, but specifically when it comes to kind of dogmatic religions. And so, you know, it made religion very much strongly imprinted on his agenda for his life, but also a great comic target.
"They got to my head. when I was very young, and they put an awful lot of what I consider to be nonsense in there. I mean, I found it very difficult to live with. The invisible God, the kindness, the heaven, the reward, justification, mortal sin, the repression of natural instincts, laughter, anything.
Dave's anger at his suffering in childhood transferred itself into jokes that were very much at the Catholic Church's expense. Not surprisingly, they weren't happy. Here's Bill Cotton's widow, Kate Cotton.
The head of the Catholic Church in Scotland summoned the Director General, you know, the chairman of the BBC, to explain about this appalling comedian who was so irreverent and knocking and damaging the Catholic faith. And fortunately, the chairman himself, Charles Curran, was a Catholic. So he could start by saying, you know, I too am a Catholic, and I think if one comedian is going to be able to topple this sort of majestic institution, it would be a pretty poor thing. And fortunately, you know, they had the blessing of the chairman of the governors to proceed, which was a great relief.
God comes down and has a conversation with Eve and tells her that she can eat of any fruit in the tree with the exception of one fruit tree. He's talking to a woman. He actually tells her not to eat of the fruit. And then when she says, which tree can I eat? He says, that one over there. He points it out to her. And she sneaks up to the tree, and a snake comes down and has a conversation. A snake. Now, if I see a snake, I'll back off. One starts talking, I'll crap myself.
No area of religion, no matter how revered, was exempt from Dave Allen's satirical glare. As Dave himself said, I'm an atheist, thank God. 1975 saw a real backlash against one sketch in particular, where Dave dressed as the Pope and did a striptease outside the Vatican. Nearly 200,000 Roman Catholics in the Northwest joined a protest by viewers and boycotted his shows. Some took a different view. Joe Caulfield.
Ireland was hugely governed by the Catholic Church at that point. So for someone to make these jokes, even for Catholics, was like, great, get them off our back. Obviously, some of the church was offended, but I think he sort of managed to charm quite a lot of the church as well, that they thought, oh, he doesn't really mean it, although he did very much mean it.
The support of several high-profile Catholic clergymen saw Dave escape censure, but he was now using his humour to expose other areas of hypocrisy. Mark Thomas.
I think it was with LWTL, a London audience, and he said, I tell Irish jokes. But I'll tell Irish jokes, son, you've got to be able to laugh at yourself, don't you agree? And people clap and they, you've got to be able to laugh at yourself. I'll tell Irish jokes if they want. Yeah, go, Dave. I said, two paddies, leave Dublin, go to work in London. The IQ in Dublin halves overnight. Big laugh. You've got to be able to laugh at yourself. Big clap. When they get to London, the IQ doubles. Silence. Now, I thought we'd agreed. And it was this moment where he catches people's prejudice fairly and squarely on the chin. I mean, he is just a genius.
The 1980s saw Dave continuing to tour with his one-man show while making several TV specials. However, this period of his life was blighted by personal sadness. His marriage to Judith ended, and he had to cope with the untimely death of his brother Johnny, who had drifted into alcoholism. This was also the time when alternative comedy was breaking through. Dave could have felt sidelined by these young punks, but just as he'd refused to be bound by the constraints of traditional stand-up, he refused to let age wither him. Graham McCann.
When you think of many stand-ups, as soon as they see that first fleck of grey hair, the energy goes and they start to just fade away or repeat themselves and they seem a shadow of their former self. Whereas it seemed to energise Dave Allen, just ageing. He never lost his momentum and it was really why, I think in a unique way, he stayed with you. If you loved him early on, you loved him at the end because he seemed just as contemporary, just as urgent, just as relevant in his last years as he did at the beginning.
Dave also made the momentous decision to give up smoking. For years, he'd smoked 60 strong French cigarettes a day. But typically, Dave managed to quit with great comic timing. Peter Vincent.
He was sitting in a plane, and the steward came in and said, I want all the smokers to go to the back of the plane. And Dave thought, I'm not going to go to the back of the plane. So he said, I'm not a smoker. And he looked at Dave and said, what do you mean you're not a smoker? You of all people. He said, I'm not a smoker. So he went to the front of the plane and never smoked from that moment on.
It was a decision that also provided a rich new vein of material.
I have given it up. I, a heavy smoker, I used to even smoke in between smokes. Have given it up. Totally changed. And the most extraordinary thing about giving up smoking, to non-smokers, I'm a convert. I've joined them. They're proud of me. They say, good for you. You've given up the filthy habit.
Good,
good, good, good, good. The heavy smokers, who used to be my allies, I'm a traitor. Bloody Judas! You of all people! But one of the good things, or one of the new things about giving up smoking, is that I now have my sense of smell back. I can actually get up in the morning and open a window, throw it up and breathe it, and smell again. Petrol. Carbon monoxide. Dog shit.
Some critics in the 80s tended to lump Dave Allen in with other comics of his time. Outdated gagsmiths who were being swept away by the new generation. Joe Caulfield, for one, thinks they got it wrong.
I think that Dave Allen was doing alternative comedy. And if everybody else around him had cottoned on early enough, we would have never had that massive backlash where people like Aid Edmondson and Rick Mayall came through going, we've really got to change comedy. But there was Dave Allen. I think he was doing it then.
In 1990, Dave began a new series of stand-up shows for the BBC, to be shown after The Watershed, allowing him an even greater freedom. Now grey-haired and a little thick around the midriff, Dave ditched his trademark stool and stood for the whole half hour, holding forth on a variety of subjects. The last part of that first show, however, ended up causing outrage after Dave uttered the F-word. We're going to hear the routine now, including that very strong language which some listeners may find offensive.
We live a life to the clock. You wake to the clock. You go to work to the clock. You clock in to the clock. You clock out to the clock. You come home to the clock. You eat to the clock. You drink to the clock. You go to bed to the clock. You get up to the clock. You go back to work to the clock. You do that for 40 years of your life. You retire. What they fucking give you? A clock.
Complaints flooded into the BBC, but Dave was unrepentant.
Tarby called him and Rick Mayall called him. He loved that bit of support. It was completely ridiculous. His whole point was that the gag would have lost its impetus if he'd used another word. I suppose he was at the forefront because everyone uses that word now on television. But the point was it was an artistic choice. He wasn't trying to shock people. It was artistic. You know, the gag would not have worked if he'd used another word.
I screamed, but I'd never heard, no one had heard it in a gag. It was controversial and I was asked what I thought. I said, I watched it and I roared laughing.
He had dug in his heels and said he won't have it taken out. But I suppose there was something about Dave, which was he liked to be thought of as a bit naughty. I don't remember him using the F word in the theatre, actually. And he used fairly broad language, but yes, it was part of his persona of being abrasive, I suppose, yeah. And he liked to be thought of as adventurous, as I think most comics do.
But I always remember him reading the reports in the paper, and Bernard Manning had said something, and he started laughing. He just couldn't believe it. He said, Bernard Manning. He said, I'm getting preached at by Bernard Manning. He found actually kind of, like, brilliantly funny.
Questions were even asked in the House of Commons about the incident, and although the BBC defended Dave, they were eventually forced to issue an apology, saying they should have warned viewers in advance about the strong language, in the way I just did. I think that might be ironic. Dave's final series was for Carlton Television in 1993 and won him a British Comedy Award for Best Performer, an award that stood proudly alongside the Silver Rose of Montreux that Dave Allen at Large had picked up some 20 years earlier. A Lifetime Achievement Award followed in 1996, so with little left to prove to anyone as a comedian, Dave semi-retired from performing. He was always a man who enjoyed his work, but treasured his family and his private time even more. Now he was free to concentrate on one of his most cherished interests in particular, painting. Dave put on his first exhibition in 2001 to raise money for the Marie Curie charity. Here's Kate Cotton.
He did a series of cartoons of people's faces using the letters of their names for a competition. And he did Samuel Beckett and, of course, Marie Curie, and there were 12 of them, and we had a competition for people who could guess who everyone was. But he was a very, very talented artist and also very clever.
Despite giving up smoking many years before, Dave's former habit had begun to take its toll on his health. Peter Vincent.
I had sensed that he wasn't well. Some years this was before he died, because he was doing his stage act, and towards the end of the thing, I noticed him leaning on the mic stand and not catching his breath very well. And he just got through that show, and afterwards he was came and had a drink, and he was all right. But I just thought, that's our last show. And it was.
Dave Allen died in his sleep on the 10th of March, 2005.
It's the nearest I come to understanding things like Princess Diana, that someone who I didn't really know,
but who I regarded as intimately part of my life, had died, and I felt incredibly sad. I felt a sense of personal loss because of what his work meant.
He was a funny guy. He was funny. I mean, you know, he's a comedian. If you say he was funny, that's it. I remember Tarby saying to me after he died, he said, you know, he was such a good bloke as well. And I think he was a really good bloke. He looked after people he loved and did his shows and made people laugh, and I think that's all you can ask for.
Death was a subject that never held any taboos for Dave Allen. He was confronted by it at an early age, and he never shied away from discussing it.
A very important part of the Irish way of life is death. See, if anybody else, anywhere else in the world dies, that's the end of it, they're dead. But in Ireland, when somebody dies, we lay them out and watch them for a couple of days. Call a wake, and the fellow's laid out on the table, and there's drinking and dancing and all the food you can eat. And all your friends come from all over the place, and they all stand around the wake table looking at you with a glass in their hands, and they say, here's to your health. And the terrible thing about dying over there is that you miss your own wake. It's the best day of your life. You've paid for everything and you can't join in. Mind you, if you did, you'd be drinking on your own.
Although Dave didn't believe in an afterlife, he never mocked the personal beliefs of those that did. His targets were always the institutions of religion, those who preached the absolutes of a heaven and a hell, and the numerous boxes that had to be ticked along the way.
One final custom that we have in Ireland regarding death is that only one person who is buried in a graveyard can go to heaven. Which basically means if two people are buried in the same graveyard on the same day, the last one in has got to wait till tomorrow.
Dave Allen's most famous routine about death. Two funeral processions in a race to see who gets to the cemetery first. They finally arrive neck and neck, only to find a third funeral party has already beaten them to it. Perhaps it said much about Dave Allen's take on being human. It was the one race you couldn't win, no matter what speed you went. Dave was survived by his second wife, Karen, who was pregnant at the time of his death. Sadly, Dave was never to see his newborn son, whom Karen named Cullen, after Dave's beloved father. In the years since his passing, repeats of Dave Allen's TV work have been scarce, but that's exactly how he wanted it. Dave's son, Ed.
He didn't want his shows repeated purely because he thought that would deny someone else a chance to get his show on television. And he was kind of he felt very strongly about that. He hated sort of tacky television, hated it.
Dave Allen was a man who never looked back, never dwelt in the past. He preferred to move on, to keep asking why, forever striving to answer the mysteries of life. Although one mystery in particular still surrounds him. Just how did he lose that bit of his finger?
I was paralysed by a presence of fear, and I felt something on my chest begin to move. It crept slowly up my chest. It came closer and closer to my throat. I gathered all my willpower as this thing came closer and near. And I grabbed it! And it was wet and cold! And I bit it! And screamed with pain! And that is how I lost my finger.
When I was very young, he told me a worm had bit it off.
He was out on the farm in Ireland and blew it off with a shotgun by resting his fingers on the top of the shotgun. Bang, and it went off.
There was some minor accident in the house, and he got the finger caught in something.
He told me that he was picking his teeth, and his brother came up behind and hit him on the head with a baseball bat, and he bit it off.
He was working with his father, and his father told him where to put his fingers, and then he slightly misheard something, and one was chopped off.
I thought it was a manhole fell on it or something, or maybe he bit it off, I don't know.
He also told me that his dad had chopped it off by mistake.
He was hit by an airbag in the car. And I said, well, how did that do his hand? He said he was picking his nose at the time.
He had loads of stories. I mean, to this day, I never know how he lost his finger.
And that's how it should be. As Dave himself said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. It takes a special talent to be able to keep a gag going for a whole lifetime and beyond, and that's what Dave Allen was. It's perhaps a fitting way to remember him. Although Dave's self-composed epitaph was always going to be hard to beat, Don't mourn for me now. Don't mourn for me never. I'm going to do nothing forever and ever.
I think Dave Allen was the great stand-up for real ordinary life. I think you can see wonderful stand-ups who take you on flights of fancy and other ones who craft and deliver a gag and some who can just produce chunks of topical or peculiar or quirky material. But Dave Allen is just someone who brought stand-up right by your side.
His legacy was just to be that slightly irascible, humorous, you know, rather delightful character. He was a master of an audience, and he just understood an audience. You know, his timing was perfect, and he just went out to the audience somehow and drew them in.
Look at the young lady who has been seduced for the very first time ever in a motor car, or anywhere else, for that matter. And she begins to weep for things lost. And he said, "Darlene, don't cry. What do you mean? What do you mean, don't cry? Please! You man, please! I'm going to go home and tell my mummy and my daddy that I have been seduced twice." He said, "I've only done it once." She said, "You're going to do it again, aren't you?"
Do you know what he did? He rose above all the crap as well. He didn't let it bother him in the end. He just thought, you know, this is how it is. He had his family, he had his home, he had his painting, he had his sort of his gags and everything. And that was it, really. I say this because I'm his son, but people I've met along the way, you know, said he was really good. And I think he was really good. He still is really good.
Thank you, good night, and may your God go with you.
You've been listening to Dave Allen, Good Night, and May Your God Go With You, presented by me, Ed Byrne. The programme was written and produced by Colin Birch and Richard Ward, and it was a Wise Buddha production for BBC Radio 2.